You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko shimina toku ingoa, no mai, haere mai, ki te wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, good morning, or good afternoon, rather. Welcome to The Wire for Wednesday. It is the 14th of June. No, it is not. That was last week. I obviously did not update my run sheet, but don't worry. The rest of my run sheet has been updated. I will not be repeating the stories that we did last week. Today is, in fact, the 21st of June. Coming up on the show today, we speak with investigative journalist Melanie Reid about the unravelling story surrounding National MP Todd Barclay. We talk to Tracy Martin from New Zealand First about the party's call for a binding referendum on the anti-smacking law. We chat to AUT's Alan Blackman for Dear Science today about how researchers have developed a solar paint that can generate energy, as well as some recent controversy around the gene editing technology CRISPR. Associate Professor Simon Denny speaks with us regarding a new survey detailing youth suicide. And we talk to Rhys Jones about the upcoming meeting between fossil-free UOA and Auckland University foundations. As always, get in touch with us about any of your thoughts about the things we cover today. 5395 is the number to text. 309 3879 is the number to call.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
So first up on today's show, a newsroom investigation has revealed a young Clutha Southland National MP secretly recorded a long-standing member of staff amid an employee dispute. Todd Barclay, the MP in question, initially denied allegations of the recordings and speaking to Prime Minister Bill English regarding it. However, Bill English has contradicted this in a statement released last night, detailing how the PM had in fact been told about the recordings almost a year prior. Barclay has continued to state he will not resign over the incident. However, TVNZ reporter Corin Dan questioned English on his way into the Federation Farmers' speech this morning if Barclay was contemplating resignation. The PM said that there was ongoing discussion regarding this. In an exclusive interview, I spoke with newsroom investigative reporter Melanie Reid regarding the investigation.
What essentially has happened is that the MP in the Clutha Southland electorate secretly recorded his staff member. And now her name was Glenys Dixon. She'd been working, she'd worked previously for Bill English for 17 years in Gore. And when Barclay became the MP in 2014, her job rolled over and she started working for him.
Right.
Now, what he did is he put what's called, well, the legal term for it is that he used an interception device to record her after there'd been a bit of a debacle over an incident in Queenstown.
What exactly was this incident?
Legally, it's a bit hard for me to talk about some of these things.
Right.
So what I will say to you is that there was an incident in Queenstown or a situation in Queenstown, and that Barclay had a big gig the next day at the Telford University where he was the guest of honour, and he didn't turn up.
Okay.
Now, it was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, if you like, because there'd been a whole lot of other incidents. So that's not really the point. The point here is that he used an interception device. So he basically bugged her office.
Mm.
And then he got the information of her talking to constituents about really private information, like private health scenarios. And he got her talking about him and her displeasure, if you like, about what had gone on. He then used that recording against her to try and get her fired, essentially.
Okay.
But the point is that he used an interception device, which is illegal, and it's up to 2 years imprisonment. So I think people remember what happened with the teapot tapes when the guy recorded John Key. we probably also remember about the guy who bugged the All Blacks in Sydney and what happened to him.
Mm.
So the issue here is that he did this, and then very soon after, everybody knew. Parliamentary Services knew, which were Glenys's employer, because Parliamentary Services hire the people that work in the MP's office. Bill English knew, John Key knew, and the board knew.
Right. As I understand it, Bill English and John Key both covered up the fact that they had known about this, with Bill English only recently revealing, actually, I think it was last night, that he had been told of the incident. Why do you think they would hide all of this?
Well, what happened is that when Glenys Dixon found out that she'd been recorded, she went to an employment lawyer, and the employment lawyer was told by Parliamentary Services, yes, there was a recording. And what happened is that part of her severance pay was paid from the Prime Minister's budget, which is highly unusual. Now, John Key, let's not forget, was the Prime Minister at the time. The issue here is that everybody knew, and why did they not just get rid of Barclay there and then?
Mm.
Because you can't be an MP doing sneaky little things like, unlawful things,
yeah,
like bugging your staff's office. So that's the big question. Why didn't they get rid of him there and then? So what eventuated is a complete debacle in the South Island, in the Clutha South Island electorate, because there were all the people that knew that Glenys had been recorded and went, we can't have an MP that has done this. And then there was all the people that believed Barclay when he stood up on Barefaced Lied and said, I can categorically assure you that I did not do a recording.
Right.
So the story that I did was the proof that there was a recording, and the proof that Bill English knew, and the proof that John Key knew, and the proof that the board knew, and that everybody knew, yet there'd been this kind of facade by everyone for the last year saying, oh, it's an employment issue, or, oh, it's, it's a disaffected member of the staff. And when asked directly, about all of this, it was kind of, he just dodged and weaved.
Yeah.
Now, let's not forget, there was then a police investigation, which is part of, my story. So the police then investigate Barclay whether or not he's committed an illegal act. And so there's a kind of big issue here as well. And there's a lot of talk about the police giving him an incredibly soft ride.
Yeah, as I understand it, the police actually didn't even speak to Barclay regarding the allegations of recording.
Right, now I want to ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
If you were the centre of if you were at the centre of some allegations with the police, and they had this evidence, I want to go through this evidence with you.
Mm.
They had text messages from the Prime Minister saying that you'd been involved. They had information from Parliamentary Services saying that, that there had been a tape.
Yeah.
They had police statements saying the Prime Minister's told me that Todd Barclay recorded me. And you said, I don't think I'll come in and participate in this investigation. What do you think would have happened to you?
I could imagine it would have placed me in a tricky situation.
Do you not think that the police would have come round to your house and got you? Well, I think we all know that if there are, if you've allegedly committed a crime and there's that much evidence stacked against you, that a squad car would come around pretty fast.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen it many, many times before with far less evidence than what was against Todd Barclay.
Right.
So it's a very big question because it affects the credibility of the police and their inquiry. They accepted a no thanks from Barclay when they sought an interview. They did not seek search warrants at his office or his home, and they closed the case despite, the Bill English, who was a finance minister at the time, confirming Barclay had told him he recorded his staff member without her knowledge.
Why do you feel the police did such a shoddy job on this investigation?
Well, I'm not going to answer that question, but I think that your listeners can come up with their own reasons for that.
Mm, yeah.
To quote Glenys Dixon, it seems that there is one law for MPs and one for the rest of the New Zealand public.
What do you take of the police coming out today claiming that they're going to reopen the investigation? Do you feel anything new will come to light of this?
They have to reopen the investigation. They've got so much egg on their face, it's embarrassing. Because what we know now is that there have been, you know, more lies than you can count. That there is a recording, that the highest people in government knew there was a recording. The whole National Party board knew there was a recording. Parliamentary services knew there was a recording.
Mm. Prison time is a possibility for Barclay now?
I don't know what they'll do. Mm. But I think the question is, why is Barclay still an MP?
Yeah, because he has also come out saying that he will not resign as well, which comes across as a little bit strong-headed in such a situation that he has found himself in at the moment.
Well, it's a pretty interesting stance, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you've lied all day yesterday, straight to the media, you've been dodging things for a year when you've been asked a question, and you've clearly committed an illegal, unlawful act.
Mm.
So the country have to ask themselves, is that the sort of politician that you want in the House?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, look, I'm not a political reporter, but we're 100 days out from an election, and clearly this is a big election issue because it's the heart, you know, it's at the very heart of the trust and confidence in the government.
Mm.
And you've got Todd Barclay standing there.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Bill English has traded on a squeaky clean image, and he's obviously suffering, like, enormous brand damage,
mm.
you know.
Yeah, this is definitely a distinct loss of face towards the National Party, as you were saying, in terms of their brand image.
They've got someone in their ranks who's committed an unlawful act and has lied about it.
Mm.
They've got a board and they've got politicians that knew about it and didn't do anything about it.
Mm.
It hasn't been a good few days for the National Party.
No. I know you're not a political reporter, but what do you feel like this will do to the National Party coming up into the...
I'm not sure, and I don't feel like I'm in the position to predict that because I'm not a political reporter.
Mm.
But as a New Zealander, I think that you have to have, you know, trust and confidence in your government, and this certainly goes a long way from making you feel comfortable in that realm.
The Wire.
That was newsroom investigative journalist Melanie Reid detailing the unravelling story surrounding National MP Todd Barclay.
Now it's time for Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party.
Good afternoon, Tracy. How are you today?
I'm fine, thanks, Shamina. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So firstly today, I'd like to talk to you about how New Zealand First is calling for a binding referendum on the anti-smacking law. So why do this 10 years after the bill was made into law?
Well, I think that the point is it is 10 years after. So, I mean, people have been either celebrating or commenting on the fact that the law has now been there for 10 years. 94 children have been killed in the last 10 years, 64 of them by their parents. And then that is more than, that's around about 8 to 10 children more than were killed in the decade before that there was the anti-smacking bill. So,
I think we've lost Tracy.
You have to decide who gave what reason for the implementation of it.
Sorry, we just lost you a little bit
there.
Sorry. But what I'm wondering though, is there enough evidence of public support for changes to be made on this issue?
There was a poll done recently where 67% of the respondents, I think it was either 835 or 935 respondents, 67% said that they were unhappy or they felt that the current law was not clear around a parent's ability to discipline their child.
Yeah, I mean, but just doesn't this evidence of public support, though, show that the problem instead is almost just a common misunderstanding of the bill? Mm. I mean, so the poll that you just referred to, that was commissioned by Family First, who were a strong opponent to the anti-smacking law, they found that 65% of respondents would smack their child to correct their behaviour regardless of the law. But the thing is, a light smack is actually okay. I mean, we've got former Green MP Sue Bradford.
You're wrong.
Sue Bradford herself, who was, you know, the architect of this bill, she said herself, light smacks are not going to get parents in trouble. And I mean, a police review concluded there have been just 8 smacking prosecutions in the first 5 years since the bill was introduced. So, I mean, the consequences of the bill have not been at all that good parents are getting prosecuted for smacking their children. Is that not correct?
Okay, two things. First of all, have you read the new powers of discipline in the Crimes Act 1981 that Sue put in place?
Yes, I have.
You read them?
Yes, I have.
Okay, so you will know that subsection 1 has a very clear definition around the fact that a parent of a child is justified in using force if the force used is A, B, C, D, right?
Mm.
And then if you go to subsection 2, it says nothing in subsection 1 or in any rule of common law justifies the use of force for the purpose of correction. And then it says subsection 3 says subsection 2 prevails over subsection 1. In other words, what Sue has done with subsection 2 and 3 is completely wipe out any legal contextual for subsection 1.
Mm.
Now, that's what the problem is. That's what the problem is, okay? And with regard to there's only been 8 prosecutions, you're absolutely right, there's only been 8 prosecutions. However, every single reporting of a light smack is now, it must be reported by teachers and doctors and so on and so forth to what was CIF. And this is from the CIF's website, and this is a quote. If a person reports smacking to Child, Youth and Family, social workers will consider it as an allegation of assault, and all allegations of assault must be investigated. So while it might not lead to a prosecution, there will be a CIFS worker show up at the door. There will be a file opened on the family and the parent, and that file will stay open.
Mm.
It'll be there.
But are we seeing a change? But what are you saying the consequence of this is, though? Because, you know, the data that I mentioned before kind of indicated that people still aren't really necessarily changing their behaviour. They're kind of still going to operate as they see fit. I just don't know if there's like the evidence to suggest that this is really affecting the way that parents deal with their children.
Sure. So I'll give you some examples of, so, and mostly this is actually around teenagers. This is around 12, 13 year olds and so on, because a child under this regulation is considered between the age of 0 to 14. So here's an example of a person who contacted my offices his daughter said, I'm going out Saturday night, I'm going doing this. And he and his wife said, no, you're not. And the conversation escalated and she said, you can't touch me. If you touch me, I'll call the police. I'm leaving. Now, those parents restrained, because this is about restraining as well, not just light smacking, let's get clear. Those parents restrained their daughter so that she did not leave the house that night. Now, they spent the next week wondering if she had gone to school and reported them to the police. Is that what we believe? Is that what this law was supposed to do, do you think?
Mm. But there is, you know, but with the change in the law, there are sort of things that sort of cater for an instance such as that. I mean, we've got, it says every parent of a child and every person in the place of a parent of the child is justified in using force if the force used is reasonable in the circumstances and is for the purpose of performing the normal daily tasks that are incidental to good care and parenting.
That's right, but they're wiped out by subsection 2 and subsection 3. Have a look at them. It says there is no rule or subsection 1 or any rule of common law justifies the use of force for the purpose of correction. It completely wipes out subsection 1, and that's what the problem is.
But then how do you distinguish between the purpose of correction and good care and parenting?
Exactly.
Is that not up to
how
the courts to decide to be able to, okay, well, in this instance, they were correct to be able to do this?
But that was exactly what the courts did under the old Article 59. So the police always had discretion under the old Article 59 to pursue a case or not. The courts always had discretion under the old Article 59 to decide if it was reasonable or not.
But
we
had
some problems with the courts definitely saying that some stuff was reasonable when it certainly was not reasonable.
Yeah, but I mean, under the old Article Section 59 of the Crimes Act, before it was amended, there was a case of parents who had disciplined their children using a riding crop, and another case of parents using a rubber hose because of the legal justification for reasonable force. So you're saying that the changes should let those things be justifiable again?
No, of course not. And they were never justifiable. What we had there was we had a problem with judges. So I'll give you another case. So there was a gentleman that was taken to court because he chased his child around the yard and gave them a hiding with an alkaline pipe. The judge decided that that was reasonable in his mind because he had been beaten with a piece of 4x2 as a child. The judge in that instance decided that what was reasonable in the mind of the perpetrator was what the law meant. I would suggest to you that it's actually what is reasonable in the eyes of society is what the law meant. And I wouldn't be advocating for a repeal back to what we had before. I would be advocating for an amendment, remove subsection 2, remove subsection 3. And then I think what Sue put in place with regard to that wording in subsection 1 is a great clarity.
Mm. So a referendum on this issue has actually taken place before. There was a citizens-initiated non-binding referendum in 2009 about the issue. And now a survey before it took place and found that 3 out of 4 New Zealanders believed the $8.9 million referendum was a waste of money. So do you believe that people have changed their view and are in support of a referendum 8 years later?
Well, what we think is that this law is not good law and that it needs to be readdressed. What we believe in is binding referendum. What we also believe is that there are probably 3 or 4 topics that you could put together and have a 12 to 18 month discussion that the country can actually, and I personally think they need to see the actual piece of legislation in front of them before they go to the polls, and then the people can vote on those issues. Democracy is one of the most expensive ways to actually run your country, but it's also one of the best ways.
And so just finally, I wanted to quickly touch on the revelations that have come out regarding National MP Todd Barclay and how he secretly recorded a long-standing member of staff during a difficult employment dispute. So what's New Zealand First's take on this? Should he resign? Should he be sacked? What's your take?
I'm not going to make any statement about what we think Todd should do. This is something for the National Party, something for the government, something for Bill English to sort out. I don't think anybody believes that the behaviour that's been described is appropriate. So it'll be interesting to see what actions they take. But that's a National Party issue, not a New Zealand First issue.
So you don't see it as enough of a problem to call for the national government. And we've got John Key who knew about it, and we've got Bill English who knew about it. Is this not a bad reflection on their leadership? Is this not such a, embarrassing issue for the National Party that you're going to call on them to take action?
Well, I'm not the leader of New Zealand First, and we haven't discussed this inside our caucus because a lot of this happened yesterday after our caucus meeting. So I'm not going to call on anything, but I would suggest that it hasn't been the best couple of days for the National Party or this current government to be seen in a great light. I mean, but add this to a whole lot of other things. Alfred Nauru, Nikki Wagner. I mean, we're seeing a pattern here, aren't we?
Mm. Great. Well, thank you very much for speaking with me again this week. Tracy, we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Shamina. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party.
The Wire.
Cor blimey, Gov. Only gone and non-stop me Jamie Oliver, innit, my son?
Oh, my God. Are you okay?
Obviously. I'm just practicing my London grammar for the gig.
Could you take my place instead?
Brit Award nominated London Grammar are finally heading to New Zealand to mark the release of their critically acclaimed second album, Truth is a Beautiful Thing. London Grammar, playing Auckland Spark Arena Saturday, September 30th. Tickets on sale now from Ticketmaster.
You love music, right?
Yes.
Then drive your stake into the musical landscape by voting for the 95BFM Top 10.
But how?
Text the word VOTE and your chosen band's name to 53955 or vote online at 95bfm.com/top10 before 6 p.m. today. Then join Pearl from 7 p.m. as she starts counting them down. The 95BFM Top 10 with your host, Pearl. Tonight from 7 o'clock and always online at 95BFM.com.
science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, now I have with me in studio AUT's Alan Blackman. How are you doing on this wonderful Wednesday, Alan?
Oh, it's the shortest day in all, and I think I've got the lurgy, unfortunately.
The lurgy? Oh, no.
Yes, the dreaded lurgy.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's encouraging that it's the shortest day, though, you know? It's sort of like from now, the days are going to be getting longer.
Yep.
We're getting closer to summer.
Absolutely, yes.
And I mean, we complain about it being cold, but really, is it that cold?
No, it's not that cold at the moment.
Cold.
No,
so
it's not that cold.
Things aren't that bad, you know? That's my hot take on the shortest day of the year, 2017. But first up today, let's talk about how researchers have developed a solar paint that can absorb water vapour and then turn it into a clean energy source. This sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Okay, so what's the biggest problem with humanity at the moment?
Oh,
what's the biggest problem that needs to be answered?
Climate change.
Yeah.
How about sort of energy?
Okay, that too. They're related, right? Am I right?
How to feed the planet and how to power the planet, basically, is probably the two biggies. So we desperately need an alternative source of energy because fossil fuels are running out, etc., etc. They are finite resource. So ideally what we want is an infinite resource, and that infinite resource is water. And we can potentially power the planet using water. It's just that we've got to find a way of being able to do that. Now, we can't really do it yet. Plants can do it brilliantly in a process called photosynthesis, so they've got it all sorted. They can turn water into oxygen.
Lucky bastards.
And there are many people beavering away in many, many laboratories around the world who are busy trying to answer the question of how to turn water into its component elements, hydrogen and oxygen, because as everybody who's seen a hydrogen balloon go off, when you mix the two and give it a flame, then you get an enormous amount of energy coming out of that. So, and also the beauty of using hydrogen as a fuel is that it's absolutely clean, because what you generate then is water as the only product. So you don't get any CO2 going to the atmosphere, etc., etc. So the question then becomes, how do you turn water into hydrogen and oxygen?
Mm.
So you can do it very, very easily. You just get a battery, a couple of electrodes, and stick it in water. And then you've got a process called electrolysis, and hydrogen bubbles off at one electrode and oxygen bubbles off at the other electrode. Trouble with that is that you're generating the electricity somehow, and you only get out as much energy with the hydrogen and oxygen as you put in to split it apart anyway. So not great. So what we want really is something solar powered. So ideally you want a solar powered method of turning water into oxygen and hydrogen. And as I said, there's been a lot of work involved in this, and obviously it's going to be an extraordinarily lucrative thing, whoever cracks this first. You know, a nice way of being able to turn water into fuel. And amongst a lot of other people, a couple of guys over in Melbourne, the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, have just reported that they have made a paint which they can paint on houses, and what it will do is absorb moisture from the atmosphere, and it'll turn that moisture into hydrogen and oxygen. And that's really, really cool. So the way that they do it, they use a thing called molybdenum sulfide, which some of your listeners might recognize as being sort of a lubricant. It's also a thing called a semiconductor, which means it can absorb light, and that changes its electronic structure, and then it can do all sorts of things to water. And they mix that with titanium dioxide, which is the white pigment in paint as well, and that sort of does the same thing. It's also a semiconductor. It's well known to do this. And basically, they mix those two up into a paint, stick it on the surface, and away it goes. It's a really, really nice proof of concept, I guess. The authors have admitted that anything commercial is going to be about 5 or so years away, because what they need to do is be able to obviously collect the gases that are evolved in this particular process, and then recombine them in either a fuel cell or just direct combustion, and generate lots of energy. So very, very nice piece of work, that. And I guess it's a sort of a watch the space thing.
Wait, so can I just ask maybe a dumb question? How do they get it from the paint into becoming an energy source? Like, how does that process work?
So
like, where does it go?
So where does what go? The water or
the height? Well, because isn't it extracting the hydrogen,
yes,
right?
Yes, they are, yeah.
So how do they get that from when it's, you know, like paint on a house or whatever? Where does
that's the problem that they've got to overcome. So they've got to find some way now of extracting the hydrogen and the oxygen. So presumably it doesn't get stuck in the paint.
Mm.
That's going to be an interesting thing. If it's just busy evolving gas within a paint, then your paint's going to bubble, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's not going to be ideal. So obviously this is one of the problems that they're going to have to get their heads around in order to make it a commercial viability. So basically they've sorted out the chemistry, I guess.
Okay.
And now they've got to work out sort of the exact, you know, how they're actually going to go about doing this in a practical sense.
Okay. I'm just like thinking of a house that has paint on it and like thinking about how they're going to collect this hydrogen. And I mean, I'm probably not the first person, the right person for the job to solve this problem, but I'm just like, how does that happen? How are they going to do it?
I'm sure they're thinking that as well. Because again, you can imagine this is going to be extremely lucrative. If they get this to work, then everyone's going to be painting their house with this fancy paint. And they're going to be able to power their house, you know,
totally
from paint, which is fabulous. So, very nice piece of work there.
Yeah, very cool. And so next today, today is the 69th anniversary of the demonstration of the first microgroove LP. Can you tell me a bit more about this?
Absolutely, it is. Yes. So again, one of the great inventions, I guess, of humankind, in my estimation anyway, is the ability to be able to record sound and be able to play it back. And the first person to do that was Edison way back in 1877 when he invented the phonograph, which was a little sort of wax cylinder which you sort of rotated by hand, and then that got improved to records, I guess, as we know them, the 78 RPM records. And back in those days, sort of the 1930s, there or thereabouts, they were big, heavy pieces of shellac, and they spun at 78 RPM, and they could contain around about 4 to 5 minutes of material on either side. So they were obviously limited in what they could do then. And again, as I say, big, heavy, brittle things, so if you drop them, they'd break. And so the task was to make a better medium for recording. And this was about the age where modern day plastics were starting to come out. And so the plastics that they were looking at in this case were things called vinyl chloride and vinyl acetate, which is why we call vinyl vinyl now, because it comes from that. And sort of in around about the 1930s, people were starting to use these sort of plastics to see if they could, number one, get more data, as it were, onto one side or onto each side of these records. And so in order to do that, they'd have to spin them more slowly. And if they spin them more slowly, then they get more rumble noise. So your fidelity goes down the slower you spin it. So, and this was to do with the very, very heavy pickups that they used to use on the old gramophones. So I guess they set their scientists to work trying to solve that problem. The problem of the heavy pickup, so they wanted a lighter pickup, and they also wanted more grooves per inch, I guess, as they called it in those days. And with the new vinyl plastics, they could fit more grooves per inch. They weren't as brittle, so you could easily get a larger number of grooves, and so therefore you're going to get more recording on either side. And in the 1930s, as I said, they started doing some work with this, and they actually did release a type of LP, but they found that with the very, very heavy pickups that it would just gouge out the grooves, and after 4 or 5 plays, the thing was gone. It was unplayable. So it took until 1948, the 21st of June 1948, 69 years ago today, there was a demonstration in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York. Columbia Broadcasting Systems, or CBS as we know them now, demonstrated the first example of a real 12-inch, 33 and a third RPM LP, and they could fit 22 to 23 minutes of music on either side of this, and basically everything took off after that. So this was a really, you know,
pivotal moment
in recording history, obviously. So the first album that was released was the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, E minor Violin Concerto, lovely piece of music. And on it goes now. And again, I was in, I guess you always call them a record shop rather than the CD shop, but I was there a couple of days ago and went downstairs and just saw this vast amount of vinyl. And I'm of the era where, prior to CDs, I guess, and so I can still remember the first LP I bought was Kraftwerk Autobahn, 19, God knows how many years ago, but oh, that's a good piece of music there. And then, of course, you go and buy everything on vinyl, and then CDs come along, and so you have to replace all your vinyl with CDs. And now it seems that the opposite's happening, that CDs are getting less and less popular in vinyl for some reason that I just do not fathom.
It's the physical aspect of having vinyl. Everything is now MP3, and you can't hold an MP3
No, MP3 is evil. No, no.
Yeah, yeah. And that sound quality, man. Analog all the way, man.
You don't get covers with MP3, but no, I agree. Record covers, yeah, that's about the only thing that I really miss about records is the fact that you get this lovely piece of artwork, which really was a piece of art back in the day.
Yeah.
And now it's all sort of shrunk to sort of CD size, but yeah, CDs are, I'm a CD fan, I guess. But so what was the biggest selling vinyl album of last year in Britain, anybody?
Last year?
Yes, of last year.
Would it be like Adele?
No.
Something like that, like a pop album?
She was well down the list. It was a pop, well, I guess you'd call it pop in a sense. Somebody who died. Somebody who died last year.
Oh, Prince.
Oh, the other one.
Oh, no. Oh, wait, who was the other one?
Oh,
I feel
well,
like it was
Shemina.
such a big year of deaths that I'm
goodness.
Like, oh, Will is throwing up his arms.
Oh, yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, there we go. Oh, my God, I'm going to get in trouble for this later. I can feel it.
So Black Star was the biggest selling vinyl album in Britain last year. It sold about 50,000 copies on vinyl alone. Oh. And the second biggest was another death, Amy Winehouse.
Ah.
It was Back to Black. So, yeah. So, 69 years after its invention, vinyl is still going strong. And, yes, should I invest in another turntable? That's now the question.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess it is kind of also an aesthetic thing as well, to just have a record player and to have, you know, your stack of your records.
And there's nothing like thumbing through records in a record store. You know, I'll give you that much, certainly. But
And so finally today on the show, we're looking at CRISPR, which is a gene editing tool that has stirred a bit of controversy lately.
Mm-hmm. Now, without going into the science in detail, because I'm not sure that I understand the science in detail, but basically, everyone knows about this molecule called DNA. And DNA is made up of essentially four components, which we're going to call A and C and G and T. And there's 3 billion of these components in a piece of our DNA, and they are arranged in particular orders. And the order in which they're arranged makes you and me, basically. So we are a product of our arrangements of these four letters. So everything about us is determined by that. So, and within these big strands of DNA, there are genes. Okay, and so genes are nothing more than particular arrangements of these four bases, as they're called, A, G, C, and T. And what we'd really like to be able to do is to get rid of the bad genes and amplify the good genes.
Mm-hmm.
So there are bad genes, there are good genes. And so a few years ago, around about sort of 2012-ish, there were a couple of women who discovered this thing called CRISPR, or utilized this thing called CRISPR, because CRISPR is a natural molecule, and a thing called CRISPR-Cas9, which basically allows you to cut pieces of DNA at specific places, with absolute specificity. And so, in other words, that means you can target particular pieces of DNA, target particular genes, cut them out, replace them with other ones, etc., etc. So this is a very new technique. It is absolutely revolutionary, and every year since then, when the possible Nobel laureates come up, these two are always amongst them. They will get a Nobel Prize for this. It's pretty much a given. It's that revolutionary. And so the problem now is that they've done some amazing things with animals with this. For example, they have restored the sight of blind mice. Simply by treating them with this CRISPR and taking out a bad gene that leads to macular degeneration, which, quite amazing. And now, obviously, the end result is that you're going to want to use this on humans. Apparently in China, they've already used this on fetuses. I believe they've done some sort of preliminary human work in China. There's a paper that's just been published in the past month in Nature Methods, which calls into question the specificity of this whole CRISPR thing. So as I said, you're relying on this molecule cutting DNA at a particular point and nowhere else, okay? You can't go willy-nilly cutting DNA all over the show because then you're going to get mutations and you're going to get unintended consequences, which is exactly what these workers have reported in this very, very recent paper. They had done some mouse studies, and what they found was that in addition to the DNA being cut at the right place, you were also getting a lot of mutations apparently at other places. And so what this has done has been to really severely dent the stock market price of three companies who are involved in CRISPR, who've raised between them $1 billion in research money looking into CRISPR, and they've just seen their share price drop, as I say, by 30 or 40%. And they're very, very upset about this because they reckon that the paper itself is flawed, fundamentally flawed, and so they've sort of put out press releases saying, no, don't believe this, don't believe this, the paper is full of errors. They only found this effect on two mice. It was a study of two mice, which, as any statistician will tell you, two is a very, very small number of N. And so the question is, would this be reproducible on a larger scale? Is it in fact correct? Is it a statistical artifact? We don't know yet, but you know, the question is out there. So if it is true, then it's going to put this whole CRISPR thing on its head, and it's going to set it back an awful lot, I would say, an awful, awful lot, certainly in terms of, you know, potential human trials and stuff like that. People won't touch it, I would imagine.
Definitely.
So what this has done, as rogue results often do, if it is rogue, is lead to the need for more research. which is
as
the way
always,
that it works.
Yes.
So, you know, more research is needed, so watch the space. But
yeah,
you know, it is an absolutely brilliant technique, and you know, the people responsible for this will certainly be in line for a Nobel Prize.
But isn't, because from what I understand, I mean, there's new stuff coming out about CRISPR all the time.
Yes.
And isn't there so much research in favour of it? So just this little piece now that's saying, oh, actually no. I don't know. I feel like that all of that positive stuff, should that not really outweigh the this one small study that tested two?
Well, no, in fact, it shouldn't if the small study was done correctly. You know, if it's beyond reproach, then just one, you know, negative result can kill the whole thing. So that's why this does really, really need to be investigated. It needs to be investigated very, very quickly, and you can make damn sure that there'll be people beavering away in their labs around the world doing that right now, because potentially it's worth a bucket load of money, an absolute bucket load of money. And again, there's been big problems with the patent for CRISPR.
Yeah.
So there's these two women at Berkeley, and there's another group over at Harvard. And the Harvard people have been awarded the patent in the US, but the Berkeley people have been awarded the patent in the UK and in Europe. And so it's all, everything's all up in the air. And you can imagine that this really will be worth a truckload of money.
It really is a fascinating piece of technology, though. If any listeners are interested in learning more about this, there's a really great podcast from Radiolab about CRISPR. There's part one and part two. So one was done, I think, a little bit over a year ago, and then another one was done more recently. And yeah, just kind of covers what exactly this technology is, as well as that whole sort of battle for the patent as well, which is really fascinating. So if anyone wants to learn more, check that out.
Good idea.
Yeah. Well, thank you again for joining us this week, Alan.
Not a problem, guys.
Have a lovely week. We'll see you again next week.
Surely will. See ya.
That was Dear Science. Life's too short for bad selectors, so improve your musical background with From the Crate. Every Thursday on BFM Breakfast, we'll treat you to a few pieces of delicious wax from Southbound Records. From the Crate, 9:15 every Thursday morning on BFM Breakfast with me, Troy. Thanks to Southbound Records, the largest range of new vinyl in New Zealand at 132 Simon Street and online.
95 BFM and NZ On Air Music presents Out on the Freak. Out on the Freak delivers three shows over 3 weeks in three Auckland suburbs. All ages, all free, and broadcast live to BFM's Freak the Sheep. The series kicks off tonight with a night of Americana at Devonport's historic Vic Theatre, featuring Bernie Griffin and the Thin Men, Josie Tuck and the Miltones. 95 BFM's Out on the Freak, number one, tonight at the Vic Theatre Devonport from 7 p.m.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
Yes, welcome back to The Wire. A new survey of 8,500 young New Zealanders has revealed those exposed to suicide attempts of people close to them dramatically increase the risk of themselves taking their own lives. I speak with one of the lead authors, Associate Professor Simon Denny, asking him to run me through the findings of the survey.
So this was a look at, really the idea is contagion, the idea that what's the risk for young people who have people in their lives who have either attempted suicide or have completed suicide, and does this increase the risk for young people in terms of taking their own lives? So that was the kind of overall goal of the paper. And so what we used for the data was a large survey of secondary school students conducted in 2012, part of what's called the Youth 2000 Survey Series, which is New Zealand's largest ongoing survey of the health and wellbeing of secondary school students in New Zealand. And as part of that survey, we asked about suicide attempts and also whether or not the students had known people close to them who had taken their own lives. So that was kind of the context for the survey, Adam.
Right. And what were the findings? Was there a correlation between those who were closely exposed to suicide?
Yeah, there was quite a strong relationship, you know, in the order of, you know, 2 to 3 times the chance of taking your own life or attempting to take your own life if you knew somebody who had, you know, done that. So, yeah, there was quite a strong relationship.
And what might be the reason for this?
Well, look, there's been a long history of this. I mean, we know, for example, even the mention of suicide and description of suicide in the media and, you know, a description around what that involves for vulnerable young people can increase their risk of suicide. So this is well known in the research area. There's also been past research that's looked at when, say, in an institution like a hospital or maybe a school, when there's been a suicide death, there seems to be an increase in people trying to take their own lives after that event. But those previous studies have been quite small, like involving one or two schools or, you know, just one hospital ward or something like that. So our study involved over 8,000 students, and so it's one of the largest ones to date that have looked at this.
Right. Your findings also point out that those students who are from families in poverty are almost 3 times more likely to attempt suicide. What might be the underlying reasons for this?
Yeah, that was another interesting finding. So we were just looking at the overall risk factors for suicide attempts amongst that the sample of secondary school students. And you're right, those students who were in households experiencing poverty had almost 3 times the risk of trying to take their own lives. This speaks to, yeah, the stress of families and the importance of healthy, functioning families to support teenagers. I think what the teenagers are experiencing is the stress of the family, and this plays out in the stress, which then results in students trying to take their own lives. So this speaks to the fact also that, you know, we know New Zealand has one of the worst youth suicide rates in the world. But the solutions aren't just within health, they're outside health, and that's a really important message. You know, if we're going to look to address New Zealand's poor youth suicide rate, we need to also start talking about poverty and the impact that has on our young people and their families.
Speaking of solutions, do you have any to propose? What needs to be done to reduce suicide attempts among teenagers?
Well, just like I said, I mean, I think the solutions, there's health solutions, and there's solutions within the health system around supporting our vulnerable young people, and depression is one of the most important risk factors for suicide and suicide attempts. And, you know, depression is treatable, and so young people who are experiencing distress need to get the help and support that they need so they can get through it. But this isn't something that, you know, you should be trying to just face out yourself. There's effective and good ways of supporting these young people. And we're not just talking about medication. I'm talking about, you know, therapy in terms of talking to a counsellor or psychologist who can help a young person. We've previously published a study that showed just the benefit of having access to health services within schools in terms of reducing suicide attempts. It reduced the suicide attempts in schools that have when they have a functioning health team by almost one third. And so that speaks to the importance of having easy access to the types of supports that young people need. The last point of this, though, is that we also need to look outside the health system. If we're going to make any inroads to New Zealand's appalling youth suicide record, it can't just be health services. We need to look at the wider society and how we're supporting our most vulnerable. What are we doing about the child poverty rate in New Zealand, which is, you know, twice that of comparable countries in the OECD? You know, so the solutions aren't just health, but they're wider than health.
The Wire.
I don't know. And frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
That was Associate Professor Simon Denny talking about a recent survey concerning youth suicide problems. And of course, I think it's our responsibility to mention the Lifeline New Zealand helpline 0800 543 354 if you need help.
That was The Wire.
Yes, that marks the end of another Wednesday show. Unfortunately, we ran out of time to play Will's interview about fossil-free University of Auckland and how Auckland University staff members have got on board with a call for the university to divest from fossil fuels, but hopefully we will play that on the show tomorrow. Thank you, of course, to all the people who spoke with us for the content we played today: Melanie Reid, Tracy Martin, Alan Blackman and Simon Denny. Thanks very much to Adam and Will for helping me out with producing today. And, of course, thank you to all of the listeners and people who texted in, letting us know about all of your thoughts. It's great to hear your feedback. Up next is the 1-4 with Bridge. He's back from his assignment writing and Will is ready to play some awesome music this afternoon, so stay tuned for that. I'm Shemina. This was The Wire.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.